and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Vildana Heirich, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And I'm Mike Regan, Vildana's sidekick and a senior editor at Bloomberg.
This week, the Federal Reserve laid out plans for hiking interest rates in 2022, and the markets initially were thrilled before really digesting the news. Our guest this week is one of the most well-versed on Fed policy and history. I actually, Mike, want to bring him in right away. It's Luke Kawa, my former deskmate, and he's currently a strategist at UBS. Luke, welcome back to the show.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me, folks.
So I said that Luke is well-versed in Fed stuff. He just so happens to also be supremely well-versed in all of Taylor Swift's verses. And Mike, I don't know about you, but Luke and I are feeling 2022, which is why I wanted to invite him on the show. And I want to ask you if you have any idea what I'm referencing.
You know, Vildana, I know you think you can burn me with the Taylor Swift references. It just makes me feel happy, free, confused, and lonely at the same time.
Wow.
I remind you, I'm the father of three daughters. And although I'm more of a Halsey guy, and I actually prefer the Scooter's versions better, I don't think you can burn me as much on Taylor Swift as you think you can. But let's see.
You shouldn't say that in front of Luke. So I actually have...
Luke's already left the show.
He's gone.
Next thing you're going to tell me you're a big Jake Gyllenhaal fan too.
Yeah. Don't say anything else. I actually have a quiz for you. Let's test your knowledge.
All right,
I'm going to read you some Taylor Swift song titles. All of them are going to be applicable to markets. And I want you to guess which one is not a Taylor Swift song.
Which
one ready?
Is not a Taylor Swift song? Okay. All right. Okay. You know, the titles of the song I'm less familiar with. If you could sing the verses and the chorus.
No. Maybe Luke will do that for us, but here we go.
Okay. Hit me.
Red.
Yep. That's a Taylor Swift song.
Gold Rush.
That.
Shake It Off.
Okay. Keep going.
Break Even. And Treacherous.
I'm going to say Gold Rush is not a Taylor Swift song.
Luke? Thank you.
Break
very,
even.
Very, very wrong.
Break even?
Break Even is the right answer.
All right. I was Chris. I thought you were throwing in a Neil Young song there to confuse me. In honor of Luke's Canadian-ness, you're going to hit me with some Neil Young.
I'll give you a 60%, I would say.
60%.
You still fail, but you get a 60%.
All right. Well, you know, my youngest daughter's biggest pastime is eavesdropping on the podcast to look for things to burn me about. And obviously that's not the first time I've made the Scooter's version joke. And she said, Dad, last time I was going to burst in there and cancel you myself personally over that joke. I don't think it's not cancelable, maybe. But anyway.
Yeah, I think this will be the last time you mention it.
All right, Luke. Well, let's get Luke to talk about the real stuff here. And Luke, if you can squeeze in some Taylor Swift references, then I will be doubly impressed. But let's start with what Vildana was talking about, that Fed meeting this week. And I know, Luke, you had a tweet that I appreciated where you're like, if you had given me the Fed statement, basically, and the economic outlook statement, the SEP, you would not have guessed the market reaction. I was kind of in the same boat. It surprised me because when I look at the dot plot, and our colleague Cameron Kreiss has written a lot about this, the notion that, well, if we get more hikes sooner, you know, we'll get less later in the cycle. So that kind of seems to be the narrative people latched onto when the stock market rallied. You know, we're going to get three hikes next year, three hikes in 2023, and just two hikes in 2024. But I don't know. Look, when I look at the dot plot, I have modest to moderate confidence, to use some Fed speak, in sort of the near-term dots, you know, 2022 dots. 2023 dots, I have very less confidence in that's what we're actually going to see. In 2024, I'm like, I don't even bother with that. I think it's way too far in advance. So walk us through, I mean, is that the safe narrative? You think that the market viewed it as dovish, at least temporarily, because of the notion that, you know, the terminal rate will be, you know, it won't be a three hike a year type of situation, that the terminal rate is kind of where everyone expected it. And how do you view those dots? Are you in sort of on board with me where the further out your dots, I don't put a lot of confidence in them?
Yeah, I mean, I'd put it this way. I think what you're describing is precisely where the market's at. If you look at, you know, if you do your dots go on Bloomberg and look at, you know, the Fed funds futures or overnight index swaps, and how those correspond to the median dot, they're pretty much there for 2022. And then the basis just goes wider and wider as you go to the out years. So I think your description there, you know, really, really does fit. In terms of thinking, you know, and how markets reacted and, you know, the digestion phase they're going on afterwards, I think, you know, focusing on the three in 2022 and then thinking, okay, now what way is the risk you really? Because for at least since the, you know, let's call it June FOMC, when the Fed first kind of introduced this idea that they were kind of more worried, more sensitive to these really high realized inflation outcomes we were getting, it's been a story of the Fed catching up to the markets on the need for some kind of short-term, near-term rate sizing of policy. But now we're in a place where, okay, what has to happen for the Fed to hike more than three times next year? Okay, so that would mean something like taper ends in March and there's no pause, an immediate hike, and going once a quarter, or it means you're going in excess of 25 basis points per quarter. That's getting to be a rather high bar to clear. So now we're finally at a place where the risk view for the Fed is a lot more balanced in terms of going forward from here. So I think that's something that provides a bit of comfort for markets, and also just the idea that if you're looking at the out year forecast, not that the market necessarily thinks the Fed will realize what they penciled in for 2022 and for 2023 and 2024, rather. But if you look across that and marry them with the PCE forecast, you're looking at negative or zero real rates as far as the eye can see for the policy rate. That's not a bad backdrop for risk assets with, you know, above trend growth and negative or zero policy rates.
And before we even get to that, let's talk about the taper. I mean, to me, if all of a sudden you remove $30 billion a month in bid from Treasury and mortgage markets, that seems living dangerous to me in those first few months. I mean, listeners will know I tend to worry more than I probably should about stuff like that. But that seems to me like a setup for some volatility in the bond market that maybe could be contagion to other markets and have a sort of an ugly first quarter there. How are you thinking about that? And, you know, is it possible that, you know, the Fed sort of, you know, changes its mind on how much it's tapering if it does see a little bit of a freak out?
Unlike 2018, it's clear that, you know, balance sheet policy is not on autopilot this time around. The Fed is being a little more nimble in terms of how it's making adjustments there. But what happened in the taper here, the doubling of the pace, that was kind of bang in line with the consensus estimate. So don't expect that to move markets too much. And just the idea that we should be looking primarily at asset purchases as, you know, affecting prices through this, you know, supply-demand imbalance and, you know, portfolio rebalancing channel. I think the evidence for that is quite weak compared to the rate signaling channel. And it's, you know, for as long as a central bank is buying bonds, you know it's not going to be hiking rates. That's where the kind of the main signal and the main accommodative impulse comes in through asset purchases. And I think it was one of the lessons from the taper tantrum back in 2013. What happened May 2013, when Bernanke started hinting at, you know, possible reduction in the pace of asset purchases, the front end got pulled forward a heck of a lot. It was traders just pulling forward expectations for when liftoff would happen based on that. So I think that was a good test case showing us that that's the main channel through which QE is working. And when the tapering pace got doubled at one point on Wednesday, March got priced as 50-50. So again, that's the main channel that I see it mainly working through rather than any kind of supply demand channel.
Valdana, 2013, that was the heyday of Scooter's versions.
Oh no. Oh my gosh. I thought we were done with Scooter.
That was the good old days.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, Luke, speaking of signals from the bond market, I know you said in a note recently that sticky high inflation and the removal of monetary accommodation should lead to higher bond yields over time. So that's not something that we've really seen recently. And I know Powell was asked about this at the press conference this week as well. So can you maybe lay out for us your reasoning for why it hasn't happened? And then second, what might actually start leading to us actually seeing higher bond yields?
Yeah, so I I think a lot of this is having a lot of humility looking at the bond market and thinking about the burden of proof required to get yields higher. It's one thing to get yields higher when the 10-year's at you know, at 50 basis points and we're all locked down and in the middle of a crisis. It's another thing to expect that above trend economic growth can continue. So I think you know, Powell hit on some good or interesting reasons. And the crux of the point that I'll interpret him as trying to make in talking about the long end is that you really shouldn't extrapolate it as kind of the pure Fed expectations over 10 years, that there are non-economic factors that affect the long end. And, you know, for instance, if you talk to, you know, any big bond manager, they'll talk about kind of liability driven investment demand. You'll hear more about the massive yield pickup available for foreign investors just buying hedged US treasuries, things of that nature. So I think that's one reason to suspect that the long end might not go up as much as you might think, given the strength of the economic recovery and the potential outlook for Fed policy rate hikes. But I also think that a lot of this is, you know, the market saying, okay, like this 2021, it's, you know, it's a good debut album. It's a good, you know, self-titled Taylor Swift. But is there a Fearless coming? What's the sophomore album going to be? Because the story of last cycle was essentially all of the risks and all the shocks that end up manifesting were largely to the downside, with the exception, I'd say, of, you know, the post 2016 election when we got excited for the potential for fiscal stimulus under then President Trump. It was European debt crisis after debt crisis. It was S&P rating downgrade. It was, you know, even brief fears of a U.S. double dip recession, China hard landing. So all of that then conditions, I believe, you know, traders to think that any periods of above trend growth are going to be very fleeting, and that the rate hikes that the Fed is kind of teeing up next year to, you know, quell inflation and to a certain extent, you know, trim demand growth at least a little bit, that's going to have a very deleterious effect on the economic outlook. We couldn't disagree more. We just think the fundamentals for this expansion are so much stronger than they are compared to being at this point post-global financial crisis. If you look at, you know, aggregate labor income, if you look at CapEx intentions, if you look at the, you know, the extent to which fiscal policy is still, you know, accommodative, given where we are in the business cycle, all of these just scream much better foundation for growth. And that's what gives central banks the confidence right now to be pulling back on accommodation, even as you have, you know, the threat of the Omicron variant and a lot of uncertainty about that. It's, you know, it's akin to, If you have a choice between, if you got a pitcher, Gerrit Cole, great pitcher, Yankees, he's injured, he's rehabbing, suffers a bit of a setback in his rehab, so he's just about, you know, at 70%. If you can choose between starting him in a game or starting me in a game, you're going to choose him. We have that much of a better economy right now that central banks can, you know, afford to do this and still have a high degree of confidence. That's how much better the underlying fundamentals are this time.
Valtat, I'll allow a little baseball talk. If he starts talking hockey, though, you got the mute button handy, right? If Luke starts going into NHL, then...
No, because we're big Sabres fans in my household. Oh, so Luke and I can talk hockey.
Although, Luke, I got to ask, so what would their album, Taylor Swift album, Red, be? I guess that's like 2008, though. You're not worried about that.
See, yeah, no, Red is what we thought 2021, like, was going to be. Just, you know, this back to normal kind of Pollyanna, we're all better, everything's firing on all cylinders. Didn't quite get there, but red was what we thought 2021 was going to be at as soon as we heard about a vaccine at the end of 2020.
All right, fair enough. All right. Well, I want to get back to that idea of you're very confident in this economy. I was reading your macro quarterly for the fourth quarter. You and Evan Brown and Ryan Primer put out. And granted, this is a few weeks old. I don't know the exact date of it, but you basically, you know, the title of it is preparing for another round of pent-up demand. You say supply chain issues that are contributing to slower growth and higher inflation will get better, not worse, as vaccinations improve public health outcomes. that all made a lot of sense at the time. And I suppose it still makes a lot of sense. But boy, this Omicron is a wild card. You know, we're sitting here in the office seeing headlines go by about companies sending their employees home again. You know, it seems like pretty much a wild card variable. Again, coming from me, the guy who worries about everything. But did that send you back to the drawing board at all, this new variant, to sort of reassess your outlook for GDP and pent-up demand and everything going forward into 2022?
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely something that if you had a base case that was very optimistic and a bull case on top of that, you have to say, well, actually, no, we got to take out the bull case. The base case is now the bull case, and what was kind of our more muddling through case, you got to raise the probability on that more. So I would view Omicron as more cutting off the right tail of growth and growth outcomes as we head into 2021. Remember that prior to the day before Thanksgiving, we were poised to see a pretty material acceleration in economic activity in both the US and China, the world's two largest economies, from Q3 to Q4. And we were about to head into this new year with a full head of steam. So that's obviously not going to happen at all to the same degree. I see more of this as more reducing the right tail of activity than as something that, very much throws us to the left tail side of equation, where we have to be worried about recession again. And from a more portfolio and asset allocation standpoint, I'd say what this does is that it makes you think a little more about what assets you think are going to be, appropriate hedges and how. So, for instance, we still kind of have a good view on the US dollar and its role as a portfolio hedge. In the event that investors are going to have a growth scare, are going to worry about the pandemic a fair bit, that usually gives the US dollar some kind of, flight to safety benefit. But on the other hand, given how much near-term Fed pricing we've had, it also means that concerns about growth decelerations have the potential to suck out some of that pricing in the US front end. So on the margin, this is something that would increase the attractiveness of US duration a little more as a hedge relative to the US dollar from that kind of portfolio asset allocation standpoint. So that's something we continue to think through and try and make sure we're as effectively and efficiently balanced in the way we're protecting ourselves from different scenarios.
So Luke, can you actually talk about some of the areas of the stock market that you guys do like? Because I was reading in your note, it says you like risk assets most levered to cyclical strength. So you mentioned small caps as well as financials and energy, regions such as Japan and Europe. So can you talk about what's behind that? I was actually struck by the energy call and what's behind that as well.
Yeah. So, and I would say that if we're talking about sectors versus regions and where is there more conviction? There's more conviction in the sector calls than the regional calls. But still, it broadly the story is similar across all, in that these are relatively cheap areas of the market. We think the kind of the macro catalysts validate being more involved in them and having some of the better or close to as good earnings growth as a lot of the tech heavyweights that have out-earned for a generation now, have that some of that valuation gap be remedied. When it comes to financials, what we see is global financials is real rates marching higher as central banks withdraw policy stimulus. And that's something that if it's not something that immediately kind of tips over a global economic activity, and particularly if it's something that's happening in a synchronized fashion globally rather than just being the US, this is something that's going to benefit banks in general, the higher real rates, even if the curve is biased towards flattening. Also, if you look at forward earnings per share estimates for the banking group, those seem like they have a pretty low bar to be revised up going forward. And part of that is the fact that especially the US banks have had a lot of loan loss reserve releases this year. COVID wasn't as bad of a credit event as expected, in large part because of all the fiscal and monetary stimulus. So, therefore, they were able to kind of release that cushion more so than others. And in other segments, like European banks, for instance, there's a lot more room for that to come down and for shareholder return programs, dividends and buybacks to also go up. When it comes to energy, this is a a view that energy stocks are discounting a lower price of oil than currently exists in the market, and that kind of this this higher range for oil compared to last cycle is going to persist. We're not necessarily in the camp that you're going to get this $150, $200 oil. That's not kind of what informs our optimism on the energy sector. It's that energy companies are trading as though the price of oil is significantly lower than it is now. So there's further room for earnings per share estimates to go up. And also just looking at the kind of reasons why you might think the oil market could go out of kilter in the near term. We see OPEC as mostly on a preset course in terms of how they're returning oil to the market in a fairly telegraphed fashion. And what we also see then is a ton of capital discipline from U.S. shale producers. So one thing that's been interesting to look at is that if you look at the drilled but uncompleted wells, the DUCs, those are the ones that essentially can get turned on the fastest when you're trying to kind of boost production. What U.S. oil producers have been doing to help boost supply off the very low levels it was at post-pandemic, but not necessarily the levels that it was at in the kind of the zenith of the shale boom, is that they've just been running down those inventories. What that means going forward is you need CapEx. And as we see rig counts go up, that's going to be not about boosting production. That's going to be about right-sizing inventory counts to a large extent. So U.S. shale companies right now are very openly being run for the benefit of shareholders, for the benefit of the balance sheet, and production growth is far down the list of priorities. That's something that keeps a bit of a lid on the supply outlook and the demand outlook. As you know, we have a very optimistic view there. So, continue to see that market remaining pretty tight.
Valdan, I do have kind of an ulterior motive. I was hoping we could ask Luke a question so loaded that he gets fired and has to come back to Bloomberg. What do you think? Is that mean?
I would love to sit next to Luke again.
That's not too mean.
In my eyes, it's kind of mean, but I'm for it.
I'm dropping a Taylor Swift reference there. You guys probably didn't even catch
it. Oh, yes. Oh, I didn't, because I figured you wouldn't know it. So,
yeah. Well, you know how much grief I'm going to get from my old man friends for talking Taylor Swift? I'm never going to hear the end of this. But
good.
Anyway, Luke, I'm going to go there. It's not quite Thanksgiving. It's not quite Christmas. And you're not supposed to talk about this stuff. But politics. I want to talk politics with you. I think you are one of the few who can talk political economy type of things. And I'm just curious. We've got the midterm elections coming up in November. Obviously, that's a world away in market time. Inflation obviously has been the biggest political talking point, right, from the right. Is it too early to sort of factor in politics, the midterm elections, into any market views for next year and beyond? And I especially, when you think about the fiscal headwind or tailwind that we had last year, and in the 2021, surprise, surprise, all of a sudden fiscal policy was a fabulous thing for the markets. But, this year I got to think, at best it's neutral. At worst, it becomes a headwind if they manage to actually raise corporate taxes. I certainly don't see any big stimulus package getting passed. At least that would surprise the market to the upside. What are you thinking about the political climate in the U.S. and that fiscal piece of the puzzle for this year?
So it's great that I can artfully sidestep this so well, because how I'm thinking about politics and the policy outlook generally is that obviously if we look back through the past 18 to 24 months, how important has policy been to the macroeconomic outlook? It's been the alpha and the omega. It's been pretty much everything until we got the vaccine, and even since then, it's helped kind of distinguish relative winners and losers and outperformers, et cetera, by the extent of the stimulus after that. The thing now is that it's less important because you've put the private sector in such a healthy shape that we can hand the baton pretty artfully that, I don't foresee a large range. I don't foresee in the range of fiscal outcomes, especially for the U.S. China, potentially a different story, more volatility there. But in the U.S., I don't see within the range of fiscal outcomes next year something that jeopardizes above trend growth. Don't see that as a factor. Think the private sector is going to grab the baton and absolutely dash with it.
That's bad news, Valdana. I think he's going to keep his job. I don't think we're going to get him canceled with that one.
Yeah, I really do miss sitting next to you, Luke.
No, I used to pick up, dig in when Valdana'd be on call. So I think that's the bigger part.
He was the best seatmate. Luke, I love this bit in one of your recent notes because I actually hadn't seen it anywhere else. It said supply constraints are in some instances consumers' way of telling corporations to increase capital expenditures. I know you mentioned CapEx earlier, but it sounds like you are expecting more CapEx, and I'm wondering why and what that means for the market.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's one of the silver linings of inflation, right? That it's in this environment, it's a little different because a lot of the supply constraints are so COVID induced and artificial. But we see that kind of income and measures of demand are above pre-COVID levels, and I suspect that body in motion is going to stay in motion. So what then has to adjust on a going forward basis is the supply side. I think we can, to a certain extent, trust companies and their CapEx intentions, which across regional Fed surveys are extremely high. If we're looking at the 6 month forward outlook for CapEx, I think also embedded in this though is the downside risk that right now nobody's talking about, but I'm sure sometime within the next year we'll start to, is the idea that because of the inflationary forces we're running through now, eventually we're going to end up with disinflationary forces. And part of that might be fueled by the capital expenditures we get. Usually it's, I forget who said it, it might've been Nassim Taleb, but he said something akin to, I've seen a lot of gluts that aren't necessarily followed by shortages, but pretty much every shortage I see is followed at some point or another by a glut. So I think that's kind of one risk, but in the near term, let's look this gift horse in the mouth. We've got a strong CapEx outlook. And one of the great things about CapEx is if you're looking at kind of the profit equation, where profits come from, capital expenditures are something that, for one company who you're buying the CapEx from, that's, an immediate source of revenues and earnings for them. But for the company doing the capital expenditures, that's being depreciated over time. So it's something that through its very act, from an accounting standpoint, does have a very positive effect on earnings, the way they're reported. So something that does inform our view that you're going to have some pretty strong, at least kind of 2017 like levels of EPS growth next year.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I've been saying for a while, I feel like there's deflation or low inflation on the other end of this when all the supply bottlenecks are worked through. If we do see that, Luke, is that where transitory going to be taken out of retirement to describe that scenario, do you think, or is it something the Fed would react to?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of an interesting outcome that I think we've seen in the past when the Fed, quote unquote, wants to hike. It will find a preferred measure of inflation that it wants to focus on to justify those hikes. I remember when, the Dallas Fed trimmed mean was all the rage within the Fed. And, one interesting part of this is that, you're going to see this big gap that we have between CPI and PCE continue to say wide and even widen further based on just shelter being a much bigger part of CPI than it is for PCE, PCE more important to the Fed, or at least, what they target. So I think that you take the Fed more or less at their word in terms of dealing with inflation. But I think it's important to remember that if inflation is clearly just managing the flip side of this, kind of managing the high readings we have now, base effects cutting the other way, some build out of excess capacity, then it would be very odd if the Fed, that showed a lot of tolerance for very above trend inflation right now, because it knows or identifies that some of that is transitory, it would be very odd if they reacted to a bit of disinflation the other way, particularly if real growth is very strong and the employment rate and measures of labor utilization are looking pretty healthy.
Yeah. All right, Luke, good stuff. Before we get to the crazy thing, Luke, I do have to ask you, as your role of sort of men's fashion icon around here at Bloomberg. Valdana, I used to describe Luke's fashion sense as risk on. Luke, now that you're at a bank, have you toned it down? Are you still a risk on dresser or more of a 60-40 dresser?
I'm a 60-20-20. So I'm, 60 equities, 20 bonds and 20 alternatives. That's I think what I'm aiming for now. Yeah.
All right. He's got a little crypto in his wardrobe. Some laser beam ties, maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
Who doesn't anyway, these Luke, days?
Great to have you. But we can't let you go without some crazy things. So stand by for the crazy things.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Valdana, let's start with you.
Okay. My weirdest thing, and anybody could have seen this coming, but it's still super weird. H&R Block is suing Jack Dorsey's Block for trademark infringement. So H&R Block said the company formerly known as Square, because if you'll remember a couple weeks ago, Square changed its name to Block. H&R said it appears to be taking a shortcut to capitalize on the well-known Block moniker and that it might create confusion for consumers. H&R Block has been around for something like 6 or 7 decades. So anybody could have seen this coming.
Interesting,
but still.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll have to follow that one. I don't know. I don't know if I'm a juror or what I would decide on that. That's a tough one. All right, Luke, how about you? You got anything crazy for us?
Okay. I'll give you a couple. The first is, so on Thursday, we woke up to a unexpected rate hike from the Bank of England. And what normally happens when you have a monetary surprise of this nature, I personally would expect the curve to flatten. It did not. It steepened by a very little bit, but it still steepened. Having 2s10 steepen on a day with a hawkish monetary surprise, that is something very weird. For contrast, when the Bank of Canada cut rates back in January 2015 in a very surprising move, the curve steepened by about 10 to 15 basis points that day. That's the kind of expectation you have. I would have thought that in reverse, given that this was a more surprising hike. The other thing I'll throw in, and it's from I think new Bloomberg columnist Javier Blas, pointing out that we all know that there's kind of concerns about energy shortages, the natural gas shortages, the weather, Europe, et cetera, what have you. He's already pointing that out, that you're seeing traders start to hedge in and build in some kind of risk premia for an especially cold winter next year. We know that making predictions is hard, especially about the future, but trying to forecast the degree of weather severity or what will be the supply dynamics, demand dynamics in this commodity market over a year down the road, boy, that seems pretty odd to me.
Yeah, where they got the old farmer's almanac out or something, I guess. I wonder if weather predicting will ever get, more accurate into the distant future like that. And that's interesting. I'll have to read that column. Javier is great, by the way. All right. Well, I'm going to try to regain some rock and roll dignity here after all this Taylor Swift talk with a story from Rolling Stone about Bruce Springsteen. Valdana, I trust you've heard of him. He's kind of like the Taylor Swift of my generation, I guess you could say. And this is not going to sound that crazy, but it's crazy if Bruce, kind of a guy who never, quote unquote, sold out. But he sold the publishing catalog, all his songs, so all the master recordings and all the publishing rights to Sony. And what that basically paves the way for is, Springsteen in some, Baby We Were Born to Run to Taco Bell or stuff like that, Pink Cadillac commercials and whatnot. But I want to play a game, get the game show going too, and play a little Price is Right with you and Luke. What do you suppose the publishing rights to the entire Bruce Springsteen catalog is worth if you're Sony Music? What are you paying? Valdana, let's start with you.
$50 million.
$50 million. Okay. I'm going to keep a poker face here. And Valdana, you're a Jersey girl, at heart.
That's here. A high price. I know. That's a pretty high price. Price tag. I mean, usually I like lowball things, so I'm going with $50 million.
I'm trying to keep my poker face here, but Luke,
So what I've done is I didn't cheat by looking up looking this up, but I was frantically Googling just to make sure. I took the what did Scooter by Taylor Swift for? $300 million. Yeah. So I'm gonna go. You know, we're definitely going under $300 million, but I'm gonna go more than $50 million. I'd say that like Bruce Springsteen is basically half a Taylor Swift, so we'll give it $150 million.
Bruce Springsteen is half a Taylor Swift. Luke, I hope your colleagues at UBS heard that and you get all the grief you deserve when you return to the office. Bruce Springsteen is half a Taylor Swift.
That's a really good strategy, though. That was so smart.
$500 million for Ooh. The Springsteen catalog. So he's like a Taylor Swift and a half and then some.
Wow. I really was sure $50 million was a good guess.
$50 million, Springsteen could get $50 million for like a show at the Stone Pony. Come on.
I guess. I'm sorry.
On the other hand, Taylor has at least 40% of her career left to go. So 300
That's true,
versus the,
yeah.
you know, the 500, I think on a
you
like.
You gotta amortize it a little bit there. Yeah.
On an expected value basis, I still think we've got Taylor edging out Bruce here.
All right. Well, what do you think Scooter's stake is worth now that she's redoing everything? That's definitely a depreciating asset, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, like let's make that a donut short, as the expression goes.
A donut short. Fair enough. Luke is short Scooter. I don't know. I think Scooter's going to figure out a way to come back from it all. My money's.
I think this is the last time we mentioned Scooter.
Yeah,
forever.
I just like to be a troll about
I
this
know.
Guy.
I know.
As you know. Well, Luke, great to catch up with you. We really appreciate your time and we're gonna have to have you back in 2022 and talk about if you got anything wrong.
Invariably. Hey, thanks for having me, folks. Best of the holidays to you and the families.
Yep. And we don't really think you'll get anything wrong. I'm assuming Luke's reports are all gonna be batting 100. Hey, you bat 51% on these calls and you're doing pretty good, I think. So Luke Kawa, great to see you.
Thank you, Luke.
Take care, folks.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.